quite the fan base. You've garnered testimonials from the likes of Carrie Brownstein and Rachel Maddow and Alison Bechdel.
Yeah, I don't know if Carrie said anything about it, honestly, but...
I think I saw something on the Twitters. But,
oh, cool. That's nice.
Yeah, one of the things I noticed right away in the book is how accurately you capture in pen and ink this town we call Portland, the gray skies, the dive bars, the old drafty houses and backyard chickens. And I have to put a shout out right now, by the way, to your chickens I'm sorry a tragedy befell them this morning.
I went out and I saw the head of one of my chickens, so my chickens were savagely murdered by a raccoon last night.
Oof.
Which is the fate that befalls many a Portland chicken, unfortunately.
Yeah. And you're famous for loving the rescue animals, because you have the whole vegan thing, and I think you spent some time on a farm that does just that, rescues what are normally known as food animals or milk animals, that sort of thing. Yeah,
yeah. I went and lived at Farm Sanctuary in Northern California, and I did some intern kind of mucking stalls labor, and then I did educational work there and get led tours. But I didn't want to live in the middle of nowhere, so I came back to Portland. But I realized chickens are so easy to have. They're so easy to take care of. And lots of people were getting chickens and then kind of discarding them when they couldn't lay eggs anymore. And I don't care if they lay eggs because I'm vegan. So I would take people's spent hens and old retired chickens and give them a nice retirement home.
Well, you know, the whole backyard chicken thing, it's... so much of what's become known as Portland culture, the do-it-yourself craft and maker movements and the eclectic fashions and the collaborative music and theater scenes. I mean, you've been active in all of those since you came here, like 12 or 15 years ago. And you know, nowadays that kind of gets... there's a lot of winking and backhanded fascination with Portland and the mass media these days, but your work has a genuineness to it. I mean, I looked through Invincible Summer and... Calling Dr. Laura, and there's no irony in there. It's all very, you know, very straightforward, I think.
It's just me.
Yeah.
I think I came here this way from Kansas.
From Kansas and from points east.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You sort of escaped, and this is part of the story of Calling Dr. Laura. You kind of escaped this family in Kansas that had a trove of secrets and all kinds of interesting backstories. The title of the book itself is actually fairly provocative. There's not a whole lot of love lost between Laura Schlesinger and the queer community.
Yeah, she's not real. She's not the first obvious choice of who a queer person would call if they were having a problem. You know, she's said some things about gay people being abominations, etc. But I still like Dr. Laura. I take what I like and I leave the rest. I leave that on the table.
And you, one of the things you reveal in the book is your soft spot for advice columnists.
I love advice. I love almost every advice. I like listening to Savage Love. I'll listen to Car Talk. I used to read Dear Abby and Ann Landers all the time. I like Adam Carolla and Dr. Drew giving advice. Again, I just take it with a big grain of salt. Sometimes I have to take a break because I'll start having right-wing thoughts after listening to too much right-wing radio, and then I know it's time to take a break. But other than that, I don't know.
Well, I understand that you do live events in your persona as Ask Nicole.
Oh, yeah, that's me. That's my persona. I can't say it right now because it's not a done deal, but I think I'm going to start writing an advice column for a website soon, which I'll tell you about. But yeah, I have an advice blog, and then I will do live advice when I give readings at different places like colleges or libraries. Yeah.
And well, let's talk about the book. This is the story, the thread that's running through the book. There's a lot of narrative stuff in there, but the story you get about your biological father, you know, you were mistakenly told that he was dead. These stories that are around him make him sound like a character out of a Scorsese film, like Mean Streets or something.
Yeah, I was told my whole life by my family that he was a con man. So, you know, that he would get people to invest in businesses that wouldn't happen, and then he would have to abscond with the money in the middle of the night, or the police would come for him and he'd have to, you know, hitchhike cross country or would steal jewels, all kinds of things like that. So I heard that my whole life, but then I also heard that he was dead, so I didn't have to worry about it. And then when I was in my early 20s, a palm reader on Hawthorne Street told me that he was alive, and it blew my mind.
Yeah, and when you first learned of his existence, you were a bit ambivalent because he came off as this exciting character, and of course you wanted to know more. On the other hand, there's this big can of worms that you could be opening up, so, you know, and nobody else wanted to go near it.
No, no one wanted to talk about it. Everyone was acting really strange. They acted strange about it my whole life, which is why when the psychic said, oh, he's actually alive, it actually hit a chord with me and rang possibly true, because I was like, well, everyone has been acting weird about my dad my whole life. But when I found out about it, I didn't want to find him right away because I thought, well, if he is a con man and if he is this kind of a crook, like, where is he going to be in jail? If he's not in jail, do I really want to find him somewhere if he's, you know, like an aged con man?
Yeah, when you finally found out, I mean, you waited longer than you really wanted to originally, but you found out there were definitely competing opinions of the kind of person that your bio dad was in the end.
Yeah. I don't want to give away the whole end of the book.
No spoilers.
No spoilers, but I did find other people that knew him later in life, you know, the people who he was associated with, or his family after he and my mom parted ways. And they had a completely different perspective on him. They said that he was a great guy and a football coach and a great person. And they didn't see the con man side of him at all. So it was quite a confusing moment.
Well, you know, this is really personal storytelling without a net. I mean, this is very confessional stuff in the book. You lay everything out there for the reader to see, your family secrets, you know, your Syrian family that kept, amazingly, you know, kept all of this stuff under wraps. Your romantic foibles, your physical and your psychological struggles. I mean, there are moments in the book where you quite literally lay everything bare.
Yeah. I thought if I was going to do this book and I was going to, I thought I should go big or go home, you know? If you're going to do a memoir, you may as well take it all the way there instead of holding back, because I just feel like that's my job. I mean, there's always things that I keep for myself in doing memoir or autobiographical work. There's always a certain amount that I share with readers and a certain amount that I keep private in my life. But for this particular story and storyline, I had enough space from it that I felt, you know, okay, I'm going to write as many things as I can about what actually happened and make myself vulnerable and write things that even make me uncomfortable or make me have a feeling now in present day, so that I can transfer that to the reader.
Well, they say that's what separates, you know, the real writers from the amateurs, is how much you're willing to put on the line.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, the first guest that we had on this show over a decade ago, it was Craig Thompson, who at the time had just followed up this debut book of his, Goodbye Chunky Rice, with Blankets. It was a memoir that became so unexpectedly popular that people back in his hometown, the families that he portrayed in the book, I mean, he changed the names, but they were still really taken aback. And so since the book came out, since Calling Dr. Laura came out, have your family members had a chance to read it? What kind of reactions have come back to you?
They have. And, you know, I was surprised. I thought people would hate it a lot more than they did. But I was really afraid. But they didn't hate it that much. I think it reopened the conversation that had been kind of dysfunctionally closed for so long. And it made people really see the implications of what keeping this secret from me my whole life had done. And I think at the end of the day, we had conversations that we needed to have, and it gave some of us closure and made us closer as a family.
That's, you know, it's an interesting way to pair this book, Calling Dr. Laura, with your collection of zine stuff. Invincible Summer is really interesting to me, because a lot of the same stuff, a lot of the same threads run through. Invincible Summer is actually a series of books, but I have the first one here, which I really like.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's...
It's a relic.
Yeah, these are... Well, you know, Portland Art Museum has them on sale right now.
Oh.
Yeah, go. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have promoted them, but hey. But there are collections of your zines that started in 2000 from many years ago. There's a real mix of material: talking dog stories, vegan recipes, typewritten flights of fancy ringed by sketches.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a much different, it's like almost a scrapbook, you know, put together. Calling Dr. Laura is really narrative. It's kind of sticking to, it's got some different art styles in it and some great, to me, great handwritten. I love the fact that you don't use computer fonts.
Oh, thank you. That was a real point of contention between me and everyone that looked at it.
Yeah, all the words in your stories are handwritten rather than printed, and it's very expressive styles, which I like.
Thanks. I think of the writing as part of the art, you know, part of the page.
That's kind of an old school, you know, some of the old, like Jack Kirby, the Marvel guys will say the same thing. They want their words to really have an impact. But, you know, you also, you seem to have a larger passion for kind of analog technology. You seem to appreciate the charms of old typewriters and letterpress machines and button makers and zines printed on paper with ink.
I love tangible things. I took a bunch of my students from the IPRC last year to...
That's the Independent Publishing Resource Center.
Yes. I took a bunch of my students from there to the Oregon Jewish Museum to see this memoir comics by Jewish women art exhibit.
Oh, wow.
I can't remember what it's called. But so it was all original pages on the walls of people from the 60s or 70s till today. And every time I saw a page on the wall that I really liked, I was like, I like this style. It was always one from the 70s. It was always an original from the 70s. I was like, this is what my pages look like. You know, it just had layers of like spackled on white out or pro white and like, you know.
It sounds like Ketcha Kolwitz's style or something, you know.
Who was it? I can't remember who it was. It was things that were so old. And I know that people now are using computers, but I just love the energy that goes into creating one beautiful page. And I like being able to go back and look at it and remember what I was doing during the whole thing. And I don't have any good feelings associated with the computer.
Yeah.
I don't get any good energy off of the computer if I look at a page that I did on the computer.
Well, you helped get the Portland Zine Symposium off the ground, and that's still going strong. I think it's not quite as huge as it was at its height maybe 10 years ago, but it's still a great place for people to just get their stuff out there, and not necessarily like you have to sort through a million webcomics, but you can actually trade little booklets and happen upon stuff accidentally that you really can't do on the web.
Yeah, it's true. I love that kind of thing, and I think, you know, people actually moved to Portland after visiting Portland for the Portland Zine Symposium, and people met some of their best friends there, got to party with people. I mean, yeah. So I started the Zine Symposium with a few other people in, I think, 2001. I think the first one was in 2001 or 2002. One of the organizers was pregnant at the time when we organized the first one, so it's crazy to think that there is like a teenager running around now who was in utero when we were organizing the first Zine Symposium.
I remember the Gakko printing workshops. Those were great. You know, it seemed like there was technology that got brought back, you know, analog technology that got brought back from the dead by people who just loved to do little basement printing, screen printing, you know, mobile stuff that can result in something really creative that can be done for pennies, you know?
Oh, yeah. I think the Independent Publishing Resource Center has done wonders for my creative process, because just having full access to bookbinding materials and crazy weird paper scraps and letterpress and GoGo printers and everything, it's all there. And it's so cheap. And so you may as well use it. And it just kind of helps inform your creative process and give you more options on how to express yourself.
Well, I love to give a shout out to them. The IPRC recently moved from downtown to Southeast, and it's at a new big place. Jason Lavian from Floating World has been on the show. He did the projects there, a big event, and Pablo DiCampo was a big part of that. So this is still going strong. The Independent Publishing Resource Center is bigger than ever. It has a big zine library, which has inspired learning institutions around the country to do the same thing.
Yeah. I think, I'm not up to date, but as of a year ago or so, it was the largest cataloged zine library, at least in the country.
Oh, wow.
Because at the time, there were like 50,000 titles, and they're all cataloged. So there's other libraries that have more actual titles, but they're not all cataloged, which is important, because then you can go and use it like a regular lending library, where you look up your titles online or on the computer there, and then you get to take them home and bring them back and have a membership card. It's great.
So I'm going to mention right now that you're listening to Words and Pictures, dear listeners, on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm live in the studio today with Nicole Georges, author of Invincible Summer and the graphic memoir Calling Dr. Laura, just out from Mariner Books. And we're also joined by Ponyo.
Oh, yeah. I didn't say this earlier, but there's a dog in the studio. She's the silent partner of this venture.
This is a very dog-friendly building, actually.
I took a chance.
Yes.
And it was correct.
So I want to ask you about some of the activities. A lot of cartoonists tend to be, you know, well, I think there's a sort of stereotype of cartoonists as being a little bit shut away in their rooms working away on solo projects. But you really get out there in the world. You're organizing workshops for kids and senior citizens alike.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've worked with groups such as, let's see, the Rock and Roll Camp for Girls is one. You've been with Microcosm Publishing. You've done some jam stuff with them. Coffee Shop Crushes. I think you edited that. Tales of Love and Lust and Coffee Establishments.
I did. John Van Oost and I edited that in 2001, and I think it's in its third printing now.
And you've done stuff for young audiences and writers in the schools about self-publishing?
Yeah. So I took the year off to go to the Center for Cartoon Studies as the fellow this year.
But oh, yeah, that's out in Vermont.
Yeah, in Vermont. But before that, I have been working with young audiences and writers in the schools. So basically that means that I go to elementary schools and middle schools and high schools all around Portland and the surrounding suburbs and areas to teach zine workshops and comic workshops and teach literacy through art, which is really exciting. And then in my spare time as a volunteer thing, I go to a senior citizen day center in North Portland called the Marie Smith Center. And my friend Mark and I just go sit with senior citizens and write down things they say and draw comics about our time with them and then put it in a zine.
That's called a Tell It Like It Is,
yeah.
Is the zine. So is this anything like Duplex Planet?
It's a total ripoff of Duplex Planet.
Okay.
it's a direct ripoff.
Okay, so it's things that folks say in the Marie Smith Center.
Mm-hmm.
And do you bring back the, once you've got it all put together, do you bring it back and distribute it at the center?
We do. They love it. Okay. We actually, we got a grant from RAC this year. We got a project grant to put out a book of all of, an anthology book of all of our zines. And through the grant, we got to give all the seniors at the center and the staff free copies of the book. And it was so cool. They were so appreciative. Our release party there had people, you know, coming up in wheelchairs and walkers, getting their book signed and then going back and reading it and seeing themselves portrayed in print and their stories actually validated by being written down and drawn and printed there for them.
Some other activities you're doing, Homo Aerobics, the queer friendly punk aerobics classes.
Oh, I haven't done that for a little bit, but I think I'm going to try and resurrect it in Vermont. Because, you know, it gets so snowy, no one can really go anywhere. So I thought I would take advantage of the students at CCS, the Center for Cartoon Studies, all being kind of bound up in this small town and see if I can get them to do some aerobics.
So what's that like? You're out in the middle of winter in the snowy Northeast, and you've got everybody shut up doing comics. But this is, what's the curriculum like there? This is kind of a private thing. It's a small group of people who come in, and it's intensive learning about the comic art medium.
Yeah, CCS is a two-year program, and people can get an MFA or a certificate. They go through a crazy comics boot camp with Jason Lutz the first year, and they get a really extensive comic history with Steve Bissett. Who I've been able to take advantage of his class through being the fellow, which is incredible. And then the second year, they work on a thesis project, which is just a giant thing. It could either be a collection of comics or a bunch of small comics or a full-on graphic novel if they so choose. So I have my hands in both years right now, and then I'm the fellow. So in theory, I should be doing a lot of work there right now.
So what's your particular emphasis when you're there? What's your specialty?
What's my specialty? Well, yes. I just worked with a senior thesis class where we did a lot of critiques. We did a little bit of reading, we did some exercises, and then we just critiqued their work to get them going on their thesis project. So they had some guidance and a check-in. point. I really like doing critiques. I think they're fun. I like giving people my opinion, as you know. And next semester, I'm going to help do a Golden Age project with a bunch of the teachers where we have them go through the process of doing a giant comic in the style of the Golden Age era in about 2 weeks. So that's exciting. And then hopefully we'll be working on a new book while I'm there. So by the time I get home, I will have something new to sit down and get lost in.
Any ideas, anything to tell the listeners about, to look for?
Well, you know what was exciting? Through being at CCS, I got to give Chris Ware a ride from the airport.
Oh, yeah. He's coming to town at the end of the month, isn't he?
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
And I was telling him about my dog, Beja, who's in the book. And he said, oh, that would make a really good graphic novel. And I was like, zing, because I wanted to do a graphic memoir about my experiences with animals, like working at the farm sanctuary or studying under a pet psychic. But I needed a through line. And him saying that made me realize that Beja maybe could be my through line. So I'm kind of working on that now. I'm dabbling in that right now.
Yeah, I'll give a shout out to Portland Arts and Lectures because Chris Ware is going to be in town. And everybody knows Jimmy Corrigan and the epic books that he's done. So you've been actually getting a lot of national exposure. I mean, obviously you're at the other end of the country in Vermont these days. You know, is there a lot of difference, regional difference these days, or is a lot of the culture? I know that Portland's culture is getting so popular, and people are calling Brooklyn Brooklandia these days. I'm sort of wondering if there's still a lot of regional differences that you come across. Do you still go back to Kansas, for example, and take in the Midwest culture?
I generally don't go back to Kansas that much. Portland, I love and I miss. There's so much vegan food here that I truly love. There are so many queer people here and feminists here, and there's kind of, I don't know, I take for granted that everyone has a baseline level of understanding about those things here, which is really, really nice, and I like living in our bubble. Vermont is, I found a very hippie kind of place to be. There's a co-op down the street from where I live, so I basically spend a lot of time at the co-op, and then within a little bubble of cartoonists there. So I can't tell you any other giant regional differences.
Well, I think there's, you know, there's Vermont and then there's Oregon, and Portland is sort of a bubble inside Oregon. Mm-hmm. I heard a funny comment on Twitter the other day. Apparently a newcomer to Portland saw a girl at a local club and dismissed her by saying she looked like Velma from Scooby-Doo, totally not recognizing that that's not an insult here.
Where you're like, that's every girl. Well, that's like one of my friends said, oh, that girl who looks like a newsie tried to ask me on a date. And I was like, which one? Or I don't know, that guy with a beard like an old prospector. I was like, where? Which guy with a beard like an old prospector? They all have beards like old prospectors.
I remember another radio host commenting on your fashion sense when you were a guest. And any listener who'd like to look you up on the web can see the vintage look that you've become known for with the cat's eye glasses and the retro skirts and the cardigans. But it's a look that you've been rocking since your childhood back east. I get the impression this guy thought you'd adopted the Portland look when you might more accurately say that everyone else is stealing your look.
I don't know. Everybody is stealing my look.
That's right.
Every person. That, like Amy Winehouse stole my hair. Yeah, somebody asked me how it felt to be a cliche, and I was like,
no!
Oh, zing! I don't know. I came here looking this way. I don't want to be a relic necessarily to the 90s, but it's just the way that I like. I like the way people looked in the 60s. I thought it was cool.
Yeah, if you go on, I guess on your Instagram, you can get to see a picture from today, and you have the Amy Winehouse hair, or it's just good looking high hair,
thanks.
Closer to God.
Thanks.
And then the nice wintry scarf that has the gold spangles in it. It's a very good look.
Well, I was trying to wear a black scarf today in memory of the chickens.
Oh, right. Yeah, you didn't have a...
I don't have a face veil. Yeah. I could put this over my face, but it might be hard to talk into the microphone.
Yes, the chickens. Well, so anything else about calling Dr. Laura that you'd like people to know about, you know, let's entice people to go out and buy the book here, because it's a big couple hundred pages of really fascinating sort of history of, I think there's stuff everybody can relate to about escaping your family, finding your own place in a new town, you know, stepping in the love cow pie several times.
Yeah, finding your own truth, finding a way to accept your family, even if they're not perfect, or not accept them if you so choose. There's you get to see my actual transcript from when I was on the air talking to Dr. Laura. You get to see me play guess who with somebody, make out with a couple of people, wear horse masks. There's lots of chickens and wiener dogs. And you might recognize some people from Portland or think you do, but maybe you don't. And you get to see a pretty accurate depiction of North Portland. So get that. And it's all gray, kind of grayscale, gray wash, and lots of drawings of me and dogs and chickens.
Well, Nicole Georges, it's been big fun talking with you today, and I hope you'll come back and see us again soon. Maybe to give advice to callers.
Oh my God, I would love that.
What would that be like?
That would be so fun.
In the meantime, can you tell listeners how they can find out more about your work?
Okay, you can follow me on Twitter, Nicole J. Georges, G-E-O-R-G-E-S, or you can go to my website, NicoleGeorges.com or NicoleJGeorges.com, or go to AskNicoleGeorges.blogspot.com.
And I think the book is at marinerbooks.com, is that right?
Yeah, or anywhere. Powell's, Barnes & Noble, or Amazon. But go to Powell's or a local place first.
Ah, yes. And or maybe, let's see, do you have any favorite bookstores? Like, well, can you get one at the IPRC maybe? I don't know.
Oh, I don't know. They don't have them for sale. Oh, also, I have a 2014 calendar for sale at my Etsy store.
Oh.
So go to my website and you'll find it, or on Etsy, it's Spinster Summer.
Does it have animals on it?
Yes, so many animals for every month of the year.
Okay. Narwhals? I remember you had a narwhal on it.
No narwhals,
before.
But there is a pig in a wheelchair.
All right. Well, the book is Calling Dr. Laura from Mariner Books, and the author is Nicole Georges. Nicole, thanks again for stopping by today.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me and Ponyo here.
Ponyo. And thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. You can find an archived version of this show later today at KBOO.FM/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter as well at wordsandpicture. No S on there. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station.
Time for the KBOO News at Noon for Thursday, January 9th. I'm Kristen Yount.
And I'm Nastasia Voisin.
Life still stinks in Haiti 3 years after a massive earthquake killed almost 218,000 people and displaced 1.5 million. The Center for Economic Policy Research broke down the numbers this week. Over 300,000 of the 1.5 million people displaced remain in camps or have been turned out onto the street. A cholera epidemic continues to kill, with over 7,000 fatalities so far. There were over 600,000 cases between 2010 and 2012. Misdirection of funds meant to help create healthcare and sanitation infrastructure ended up going to offshore contractors. In fact, 67.1% of USAID monies went to firms out of Washington, D.C., while just 1.3% has gone to Haitian companies. Only 9% of the $6.43 billion dispersal went through the Haitian government. 750 houses for contract workers were built at a cost of $20 million, and around 90 houses were built for U.S. Embassy staffers, which cost between $85 and $100 million. Last month, Democratic representative from California, Barbara Lee, along with 34 co-sponsors, initiated the Assessing Progress in Haiti Act, which passed in the House. This move gets the approval of the Center for Economic Policy and Research spokesperson Mark Weisbot, who said, "The least that the UN and the international community could do is to clean up the mess that they themselves made. This means providing infrastructure for clean water as quickly as possible to get rid of the deadly cholera bacteria that the UN troops, who did not come to Haiti for earthquake relief, brought to the country." Faizbot was referring to the UN peacekeeping troops, or the United Nations Stabilization Mission in Haiti, also called MINUSTAH, that has been in Haiti since 2004. After the earthquake, poor construction of sanitation systems at the UN base caused sewage to continuously spill into a major waterway used for drinking, cooking, and bathing, sparking the epidemic that's gone on for 3 years. The UN has never apologized for the accident and has only pledged 1% of the $2.2 billion necessary to clean it up.
A pro-fracking educational program sponsored by Disney and funded by Ohio's oil and gas industry has environmentalists and parents outraged at what they call a hijacking of public education. The program, called Rocking in Ohio, is an educational roadshow which includes interactive lessons on how gas and oil pipelines function. Radio Disney went on a 26-stop tour of science centers and elementary schools across Ohio last month. The program was entirely funded by the Ohio Oil and Gas Energy Education Program. Environmentalists are condemning Disney for promoting the controversial fracking industry. While fracking has brought an energy boom to Ohio, activists contend that the practice leads to water contamination, poor air quality, and climate change. The absence of anti-fracking programs and the involvement of media giant Disney has parents accusing Ohio public schools of tolerating propaganda. Radio Disney says it plans to expand the program to other states if the Ohio shows are successful.
Yesterday, the Portland City Council released their quarterly report regarding the state of the Water Bureau. The report talks about upcoming projects that will affect the transmission of water to Portlanders from the Bull Run watershed. The list of projects does not include construction of UV filters for treatment of cryptosporidium. To find out more about what the city plans to do, please check out Nick Fish's page at www.portlandonline.com.
A bloody crackdown on garment workers in Cambodia's capital has human rights organizations condemning the country's harsh stance on public dissent. Five people were killed and dozens injured when security forces moved against a government protest group allied with labor activists. A general ban against demonstrations is now in force. 23 factory workers and activists, some who were peacefully protesting, are being held in a remote prison known for its harsh conditions.